ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, a major fire at a Victorian oil refinery increases fears about the security of the nation's fuel supplies. Also, the government unveils its plan to boost defence spending, and an Australian citizen accused of training Chinese military pilots to be extradited to the United States.
Announce a decision for the Prime Minister whether he wants to send an Australian citizen who's already been in prison for around 3.5 years into the hands of the Trump administration, who has taken a close interest in this matter.
First this evening, the timing couldn't be worse. Just as the security of Australia's fuel supplies over the next few months are far from guaranteed because of the Middle East conflict, a huge fire has damaged one of the nation's two remaining oil refineries. The Viva Energy plant at Geelong, southwest of Melbourne, supplies about half of Victoria's fuel and about 10% of the nation's. The federal government has described the fire as a setback. Authorities are blaming the 12-hour blaze on a gas leak. Kimberly Price has more.
As Australians deal with the steep rise in prices at the Bowser, one of the country's two oil refineries has been hit by a raging fire. Geelong resident Peter Bartels was sitting at home late last night when he heard a siren.
Then I heard another one straight after. I thought, hello. So I normally walk out in, open the gate and have a bit of a look, but I couldn't see anything anywhere. So I went back inside. Then the siren started again, and that's when the flames were going berserk.
Another local, Benny Young, took his children out to see the blaze.
First thing you noticed was the sound. It was just like this ominous hissing sort of noise. We walked along and you could see all the fire down the bottom with all the water being sprayed up at it. That was pretty intense.
The fire began around 11 p.m. last night. Incident controller Anthony Pierce describes the scene.
In the early stages of the fire, it was very, very dangerous and there were explosions occurring.
After burning for more than 12 hours, the fire at the Viva Energy oil refinery in Geelong was put out just after midday. Around 50 firefighters battled the inferno and no one was harmed. Anthony Pierce says investigations into the cause of the blaze are underway.
So the actual mechanisms that caused it, we're still investigating, but there was a leak of gas from a mechanical component in the system. The gas has then appeared to have ignited, but the details of the investigation will come to light in further days to come.
The Geelong refinery makes around 7 million litres of petrol a day. The fire only affected one section in the refinery. Diesel and jet fuel is still being produced there today, albeit at a reduced level. It's unclear how this fire will affect the nation's fuel stocks.
This is not a positive development. This is not good timing, and this is a setback.
Chris Bowen is Australia's energy minister. He says the unit hit by the fire produces petrol and fuel for small planes.
We use about 6 million litres a month of aviation gasoline, and we have 23 million litres in stockpile, around 116 days in reserve.
The refinery's general manager, Bill Patterson, is confident Viva will not fall short in delivering fuel as planned.
Yes, so we've got substantial stocks of petrol, and our supply, apart from the petrol that we make here at the refinery, we do import petrol into the country. We also have arrangements with other participants in supply markets. So on the basis of our outlook, we're pretty confident that there's not going to be an issue on that front.
Questions are being raised about the age of infrastructure on the site, which was originally built and operated by Shell Australia in the 1950s.
The condition of the equipment that was involved in this event will be definitely part of the investigation.
Professor Yuan Chen is from the School of Engineering at the University of Sydney.
They use crude oil and heated to 300 or 400 degrees. then the crude oil will vaporize into vapor. Then you will be able to separate the different fraction from the crude oil, for example, petrol, diesel.
Yuen Chen says new infrastructure has been implemented at the Geelong site since it was established 7 decades ago, but it's unclear if equipment was outdated.
It's a relatively old refinery, have been run for many, many years.
These refineries do need to be updated over time. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, of course, because you can imagine the whole process, you run at a very high temperature, pressure, and also you have a flammable gas in the reactor. So you have a lot of the pressure sensor, temperature sensor, all the valves, they have to be routinely maintained. Renewed in a way.
While he believes there should be little disruption to the nation's fuel supply, it may be a different story for Victoria.
Because this plant is based in near to Melbourne, so in a short term, I think Victoria maybe will be impacted more.
Meanwhile, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is continuing his tour to Asian nations to shore up the country's fuel imports. He says an extra 100 million litres of diesel has been secured in 2 shipments from Brunei and 1 from South Korea. Those additional fuel shipments are expected to arrive in May.
Kimberly Price reporting. So, how is the fire at the Geelong refinery going to affect Australia's fuel supplies? For more on that question, I spoke to Kaushal Ramesh, an energy analyst at Rystad Energy.
Firstly, refineries are designed to handle fires. So as of this point, the diesel and jet fuel production, which are the two key grades of fuel imports into Australia, that has been precautionally curtailed. It would depend on how quickly production is able to come back. And a lot of that is going to depend on the safety inspections and the restart process. But we think, obviously, this is, as we said, very bad timing, and it is going to increase the volume of imports required to tide over this production loss.
So you just said supplies have already been curtailed?
Production has been curtailed as a precautionary measure.
The Energy Minister, Chris Bowen, has said this afternoon that Viva Energy is confident it'll be able to replace the affected petrol production with imports. They're intending to order more, obviously, from overseas. Is that feasible, given the global situation?
Well, the good news on the global side is that it does appear that the US and Iran are inching towards a deal. So at least we have some optimism on that front. So at this moment, it is still remains feasible. But in the event that there is a return to hostilities on that front, we will end up with physical shortages in a few months' time.
This Viva plant at Geelong in Victoria apparently supplies about 50% of Victoria's fuel supplies, about 10% for the rest of the nation. So are you expecting Victoria will be the primary victim here, or do you expect fuel supplies in other parts of the nation could be affected as well?
There could be some knock-on impact at the other regions as well, but obviously the key impact is going to be in Victoria.
The federal government has introduced a 4-stage fuel security plan in the wake of the Middle East conflict. We're at stage 2 now, where we're asked to only buy the fuel we need and try and use less. Do you think, as a result of this fire, the government is going to have to look at taking us into level 3?
We do believe that that needs to be considered, but that is on account of the global situation. Obviously, this could be the measure that sort of pushes us over the edge. On the global side, and even as we inch towards a deal between the US and Iran, the reality is that it will take a long time before flows through the Strait of Hormuz are normalized. So it does seem that we're headed in that direction.
And Kaushal Ramesh, just remind us what stage 3 of the federal government's plan involves.
That's largely around targeted reductions in consumption and beginning to hold consumption only for the more important sectors.
So that would be things like farming and emergency services, is that right?
Yes.
The Middle East conflict and now the fire at this refinery is really highlighting Australia's situation when it comes to producing its own fuel as we've mentioned, we've only got two refineries left. What do you think are the long-term implications?
Firstly, I should say that Australia and New Zealand are unique in the OECD for being, you know, fairly focused on energy security, but then being very heavily dependent on fuel imports and having, I think Australia in particular has very few days of fuel reserves. So we do think the implication has to be around mitigation steps to avoid further such circumstances, particularly around increasing the volume of fuel reserves. And looking out a little bit longer term from that point, it is also possible that this galvanizes the move towards electrification of transport.
Kaushal Ramesh is an energy analyst at Rystad Energy. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on ABC Listen. Well, as we just heard, there are hopes a deal for lasting peace between the United States and Iran may soon eventuate. Senior Pakistani mediators have arrived in Tehran, trying to revive the talks between the two nations before the current ceasefire expires on Wednesday. And Israel and Lebanon are also planning further discussions, despite Israeli strikes killing four rescue workers in southern Lebanon. Rachel Hayter has this report.
After an historic meeting in Washington, mediated by the United States, Israel and Lebanon will hold direct talks tomorrow, according to the US President, Donald Trump.
Trying to get a little breathing room between Israel and Lebanon. It has been a long time since the two leaders have spoken, like 34 years. It will happen tomorrow. Nice.
The meeting is planned despite the Israeli military killing four Lebanese rescue workers and wounding six others in three consecutive strikes in the southern Lebanese village of Meyfadoun. Lebanon's Islamic Health Committee says a group of medics responding to a distress call from wounded civilians was hit. Then a second group was hit while trying to help the wounded team. And a third group was hit while rushing to help the first two teams. The Lebanese Health Ministry has condemned the attacks as a violation of international law and says since this war started, Israeli strikes have killed at least 91 Lebanese medical workers. The Israeli military responded to a request for comment on the strikes, saying it's looking into what happened. It's previously accused the Iran-backed Hezbollah of using ambulances as cover for militant activities. Earlier, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu released a video statement saying the IDF continues to strike at Hezbollah in Lebanon and outlining his goals for direct talks.
In talks with Lebanon, there are two main objectives: dismantling of Hezbollah and sustainable peace that is achieved through strength.
Pakistan has meanwhile sent a high-level delegation to Tehran, seeking to revive peace talks between the United States and Iran before the fragile ceasefire expires on Wednesday. Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Esmail Baghaei says no extension of the ceasefire has been agreed.
The talks are continuing through Pakistani mediation, and it remains to be seen how serious the other side really is about the claims it's made about diplomacy. It's the United States that must prove its sincerity and prove itself.
The White House Press Secretary, Caroline Levitt, confirmed there's been no extension to the ceasefire.
I saw some reporting, bad reporting this morning, that we had formally requested an extension of the ceasefire. That is not true at this moment. We've remained very much engaged in these negotiations, in these talks.
Meanwhile, treasurers and finance ministers from 11 countries, including Australia, have released a joint statement calling for the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz. The statement says disruption to global supply chains is harming poorer countries the most.
Rachel Hayter with that report. In a speech to the National Press Club today, the Defence Minister, Richard Marles, has unveiled a plan to lift defence spending by $53 billion over the next decade. For more on this, I spoke to the ABC's foreign affairs reporter, Stephen Jedgetts. Stephen, how did the Defence Minister, Richard Marles, frame this new strategy?
Well, look, Sam, we're pretty used to senior ministers in this government painting a pretty grim picture of the strategic environment, and today was no exception. Richard Marles, again, warning that the world around us is more dangerous than it's been for decades and Australia's position more precarious than it's been for any time in recent memory. Interestingly, he touched on some of the recent debates that have been swirling around here, but also internationally, about how to deal with the Trump administration, which has taken an axe to many of the assumptions that Australian military planners have had for quite some time. Sometimes, or at times, you hear commentators and some inside Parliament saying it's time to ditch the alliance with the US, given the enormous unpredictability of the Trump administration and its contempt for international law. And we heard a version of that, though not quite the same, from Mark Carney, the Canadian Prime Minister, not that long ago. He's warned, of course, that the international order is now effectively dead, buried and cremated, and is suggesting a coalition of middle powers to try and curb the excesses of the sometimes predatory hegemons, the US and China. Richard Marles was very keen to push back on that today. He said that whilst it was undeniable that the US was taking a different approach and that the US was pushing countries towards spending more on money whilst obviously playing down the importance of the rules, he said for Australia to abandon the international rules entirely would be a grave mistake, because if the world leans only on power, then middle powers like Australia are gravely disadvantaged. He also said that middle powers would only go so far. Yes, it's important, he said, to do middle power diplomacy, but in the end, if Australia wants to balance growing Chinese military might in this region, then he argued the only way to do that was through the military strength of the United States, working in concert with allies.
Now, I understand US frustrations that allies might seek to free ride on this US leadership, or believe that somehow the order acts as a substitute for hard power. It does not. Any rules-based order can only prevent conflict when it is underpinned by the hard power necessary for collective deterrence. Australia must contribute to this, and we are. And we will work with all our like-minded partners to better shape our region's strategic trajectory. We will double down on middle power cooperation, but let's also be clear. There is no effective balance of power in the Indo-Pacific, absent the continued presence of the United States.
Richard Marles is the Defence Minister and Acting Prime Minister at the moment, with Anthony Albanese overseas. So, Stephen, what are the main shifts in defence spending in this document?
Look, in many ways, this document reinforces what we saw out of the last defence strategy, which was revealed in 2024, which represented a bit more of a sharp break from the past. This time, we see more continuity than change. The basic argument is very much the same. Australia needs to be able to project force by investing in things like nuclear-powered submarines, which we're trying to get through AUKUS, in order to hold enemies at bay. The fear, of course, is not one of invasion necessarily. The government still thinks that's very unlikely, but more another unnamed great power or any power being able to really coerce Australia through the threat of military force. So there's a big pivot there towards spending on things like dealing with the threat of drones, whilst, you know, investing in our own drone capability, missile defence climbing from, you know, around $18 billion to up to $30 billion over a similar time frame, as well as heavy spending on guided weapons and explosive ordnance. That's climbing from up to about $36 billion over the decade ahead. Again, that's above the $21 billion or so that we saw previously. So some substantial increases there. There are also some cuts, or what the government calls reprioritizations, with money being cut from some programs and poured into these new priorities like drones and missiles. We don't know what most of them are. One example we do have is the a fleet of 10 C-27 Spartan aircraft, which have often been used to move personnel around the Pacific. The government evidently believes they're too expensive and are replacing them with the commercial planes instead. Now, the coalition says it's still trying to get to grips with the details of this document, which is fair enough. It has only just landed a few hours ago. But James Patterson, the Shadow Defence Minister, told the ABC's afternoon briefing he agreed with the broad thrust of investment in more investment in things like drones, but he wasn't necessarily convinced the government had yet done enough in this space.
It is the right direction, but it's 4 years since the invasion of Ukraine by Russia and a couple of years now since we've had conflict in the Middle East. So it's been very clear we're in the age of missiles and drones, and the government has been slow to move on this. Mm. Their two biggest achievements that they like to boast about when it comes to drones is the Ghost Bat and the Ghost Shark. Now, both of those drones, one underwater, one in the air, was started under Peter Dutton as defence minister under the previous government 4 years ago. So in terms of new capability that they've actually made decisions on, there's very little on the ground.
James Patterson is the opposition's defence spokesman. And Stephen, the Prime Minister has announced during his visit to Malaysia that the government has secured more diesel shipments through what are known as its strategic reserve powers. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's right, Sam. The Prime Minister is visiting Malaysia at the moment for talks with Anwar Ibrahim, where he's once again secured a broad statement, a commitment from Malaysia to do what it can to keep energy flowing. That's, of course, if it can meet its own domestic needs. But he's made a more concrete announcement as well, saying that Australia's now secured an additional 100 million litres of diesel under laws that were passed in Parliament last month, which allows companies to buy fuel where the government basically takes on the financial risk of shipments that might otherwise be too expensive. Now, these two shipments, one has come from Brunei or will come from Brunei, the other from South Korea. And the Prime Minister says it's the first of what he expects to be, quote, many shipments that will be secured under these new strategic reserve powers.
Stephen Jedgetts with that report. A former American Marine pilot accused of unlawfully training Chinese military pilots has lost his federal court bid to avoid extradition to the United States. Daniel Duggan is now an Australian citizen and denies the allegations. His lawyers are calling on the Prime Minister to intervene to prevent his return to the US. Alexandra Humphreys reports.
Daniel Duggan's supporters had high hopes that the federal court would find in favour of the former United States Marine Corps pilot and put a stop to his extradition. It wasn't to be.
He's missed so much in our family, in our children's lives.
Mr. Duggan's devastated wife, Safreen, spoke outside court of the loss she and her six children have suffered since her husband's arrest in 2022 at the request of the United States.
We are an Aussie family who has had my husband, father, son-in-law, our property and our feeling of safety stripped away from us.
Former Australian Attorney General Mark Dreyfus signed off on Mr. Duggan's extradition in 2024. Mr. Duggan's legal team unsuccessfully tried to argue that decision was made in error. They argued the extradition treaty between Australia and the United States stipulates there must be equivalent charges in the jurisdiction where extradition is requested from. And the conduct Mr. Duggan is accused of wasn't an offence in Australia at the time.
We are very disappointed by this ruling, and we will consider our options carefully. But make no mistake, we will not give up.
Mr. Duggan, who is now an Australian citizen, has been detained in a maximum security prison since his arrest. He's facing four charges in the United States, including allegations that he violated and conspired to violate the US Arms Export Control Act, as well as a charge of conspiracy to commit money laundering. The charges relate to Mr. Duggan's work between 2010 and 2012 as an instructor at a South African flight school. The US claims he received payments to train Chinese military pilots in violation of arms trafficking laws, something Mr. Duggan denies. He faces up to 65 years in prison if found guilty. Donald Rothwell is a professor of international law at the Australian National University.
When Mr. Duggan was in the US military, he was a US citizen. He was therefore subject to US law. And even when he separated from the US military, he remained subject to US law with respect to a range of activities being conducted not only within the United States, but also beyond the United States, especially as they related to any activities that are associated with the very specialised military training that he received.
Professor Rothwell explains that while today's ruling is a blow for Mr. Duggan, his case may not be over yet.
At the moment, there are really two avenues that might bar Mr. Duggan's extradition. The one is that he's successful in terms of any ongoing legal challenges against the US extradition. And even if he doesn't succeed through those processes, there's always the potential that the Commonwealth Attorney General, who needs to issue a certificate for an extradition to occur, might seek to take into account a range of factors concerning Mr. Duggan's case and ultimately decide to deny extradition in this particular instance.
An appeal can be lodged within 28 days. Outside court, Kaleri lawyer's legal clerk Lynn Stocker called on Prime Minister Anthony Albanese to intervene.
Announce a decision for the Prime Minister whether he wants to send an Australian citizen who's already been in prison for around 3.5 years into the hands of the Trump administration, who has taken a close interest in this matter.
Professor Rothwell again.
Well, there's always a political element involved in an extradition, and certainly that becomes even more prominent when the extradition matter is one that's generating some public attention and interest in the community. Politicians need to be very aware of not succumbing to those political pressures, but nevertheless, there are sometimes legitimate grounds upon which extradition can be denied, especially on humanitarian grounds, on questions being raised about whether or not the individual whose extradition is being sought is actually able to be extradited because of their health. So there's a range of factors that politicians can necessarily take into account that the courts cannot.
Attorney General Michelle Rowland said in a statement that the government noted the decision and that Mr. Duggan will remain in extradition custody in Australia until his surrender to the United States of America.
Alexandra Humphreys reporting. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on ABC Listen. And that's where you'll find ABC News Daily with Sam Hawley each weekday morning too. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Debate over the US leader's mental health has reignited since he began verbally attacking the Pope and posted an AI image depicting himself as Jesus. Today, David A. Graham from The Atlantic magazine on what Trump's behaviour says about his ability to govern. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.